This is John Rhys Davies, Sarah from the Indiana Jones movies, Gimli from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and the Kingpin from the Trial of the Incredible Hulk. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Comic book fans, welcome. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. If you're a regular listener of this podcast, welcome back to the lair. If you're joining me for the first time, well, thanks for giving Comic Book Central a listen. This is the show that celebrates our favorite comic book characters coming to life on stage, in the movie theaters, on our TV screens, and at comic book conventions around the country. Comic book conventions like the Cincinnati Comic Expo. Now, if you listened to the show last week, you know we are in the middle of my adventure at the Expo. Last week, I got things started by chatting with show co-runner Matt Bredesteggy, comic book legends Marv Wolfman and Bob Layton, and I got to hang out with the Incredible Hulk Lou Ferrigno, who also happened to be my guest on episode 24 of Comic Book Central. Now, this week, the fun continues, and with this very episode, we've got another epic podcast crossover. And the Expo played host to a couple of special guests from the world of Indiana Jones. It's one of my favorite worlds. So, of course, your intrepid reporter recorded some interviews, which will also be part of the IndieCast. That's right, hosted by Ed Dalista. The IndieCast is the world's premier Indiana Jones podcast.
Tune in each fortnight to the IndieCast, the world's number one Indiana Jones fan podcast.
Trust me.
Featuring the latest news, reviews, and interviews with on-screen and behind-the-scenes talent who help bring to life the greatest adventure movie series ever made. Each episode has the latest from the world of Indiana Jones, as well as interactive segments, trivia, contests, and specials, including radio dramas and music retrospectives. The IndieCast.
It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God.
Available in iTunes or listen directly at theindiecast.com.
If adventure has a name, it must be the IndieCast.
Ed and company are fast approaching the 7th Indieversary of the podcast. It's coming up this November, so happy Indieversary, Ed. And I'm proud to have been a part of the show in recent years, along with my further adventures of Indiana Jones buddy, Keith Voss. So thanks, Ed, for letting me be a part of the fun. Now, the two indie-themed interviews that I conducted at the Expo are with stuntman extraordinaire Dickie Beer and indie sidekick in two cinematic adventures, of course, the greatest film of all time, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and also Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the man who played Sala, the man who also roamed Middle-earth as Gimli, and the man who, as the Kingpin, took on Daredevil and Lou Ferrigno's Hulk, John Rhys Davies. Now, those chats are going to be on the IndieCast this Monday, and Ed will have so much more on the podcast as well. So make sure you check it out, the IndieCast.com. Now, I'll get to those interviews here on Comic Book Central shortly, but first, I want to head back to one of the greatest years in movie history, 1980. That was the year The Empire Strikes Back blasted into theaters. Flash Gordon took on Ming the Merciless while the soundtrack from Queen thundered in the background, and Superman 2 premiered in Australia. Now, other than 1980, what do those three films have in common? Well, they all feature my first guest, actor John Morton. And John was at the Expo as part of a Star Wars Boba Fett reunion, along with, as we mentioned, stuntman Dickie Beer, who was a Boba Fett stuntman in Return of the Jedi. You'll hear from him shortly. And also Daniel Logan, who played young Boba Fett. In addition to suiting up briefly as the intergalactic bounty hunter in Empire Strikes Back, John Morton was also one of the good guys in the film. You might remember him as Dak Ralter. That's right, Luke Skywalker's ill-fated snowspeeder gunner in the Battle on Hoth. In fact, ill-fated could also describe his role as the airplane pilot at the beginning of Flash Gordon. And Nate, the astronaut in Superman 2.
Houston calling RMS 2. Come in. Fort Houston?
Oh, hold on, mate.
Yo.
How are things going?
Well, all systems normal, Houston. Andy's out doing the geological survey.
Okay. And more rocks, huh? Nice.
And cosmonaut Boris is getting some soil samples.
Surface conditions unchanged.
Well, it's mighty pretty out there. Mighty... pretty.
Mighty pretty. Right. Look, Nate. Nate, wake up, will you?
That's it. I'm dreaming.
Artemis, come in.
Well, Houston, we seem to have an unidentified flying object.
Unidentified?
What does it look like?
Well, a lot like a girl.
Ah, Nate, if only you knew that was a Kryptonian supervillain. You could have hightailed it off the moon and made it out alive. Oh, anyway. All right, here it is. From Superman to Star Wars, my conversation with John Morton. Joining me now is John Morton, who I'm actually going to refer to you as Mr. 1980, if you don't mind.
Why is that?
You are in three of my favorite films from 1980. This is ridiculous. Empire Strikes Back, Flash Gordon, and Superman 2.
Well, also the great American actor who worked in London who cornered the death market in outer space death scenes. I got crushed.
Let's talk a little bit about one of my favorite films, Superman 2. Mm-hmm. You play Nate, the astronaut. Now, Nate's the guy that almost gets away.
Yeah.
If you remember, first of all, tell us your first line, because I think when you say the line about Ursa, yeah, I think we'll know who you are.
Well, it's John Ratzenberger, who's playing at the Houston controls, saying, "Well, what's it look like?" And I said, "Well, it looks like a girl." And then so Ratzenberger says, "What's a curl?"
It's a comet with an east-west trajectory, right?
Yeah,
I've seen the movie a few times.
Yeah, and actually, I think there is something that the European Space Agency has sent up that's riding on a comet right now.
Yes, and I actually have seen the word curl come up in some of these discussions, too. So, unfortunately, it was a girl. It was Ursa.
That's right.
You didn't make it off the moon.
I did not.
But it's a classic character. It's a classic moment. What was it like to kind of shoot that scene? Because was this shooting as part of one at the time?
Well,
or was this the reshoots when they came back under Lester?
That's an interesting story. I can go down this rabbit hole for some length of time because it is quite interesting. When the Salkin brothers decided that they wanted to do Superman, they had in their mind to do two for the price of one. So there was a bit of an issue. So my initial work, the long shots, the establishing shots, were done with Richard Donner in 1977, in the summer of 77. And then they got all wrapped up in the full role of the business, and there was some contract issues with...
Now, these are all the shots that we see, the capsule, we see the astronauts going around, walking, so Donner's shooting all that.
That, yeah, and that, as I remember, that was really interesting, and I'll go back to it, because that was the most interesting part. Then they had to put out Superman 1, and they had, as I said, the contractual issues with Marlon Brando that, you know, got to be quite interesting, and I don't remember the details, but Brando finally worked out that even though he's being paid seven figures, he was being used in two films, and that I don't remember how that resolved, but in any event, they didn't get back to the...
Well, he's not in two. His hands are.
Yeah, well, that probably was part of that. You'd know more than I. When they got around to finally doing the close-up scenes, it was, Richard Lester, who actually I'd worked with in Cuba the year before, who was finishing up the film. And so that was on the same set, as I recall, but that was a different director, and it was a different focus. And those, all the interior shots that were the close-ups were done at that time.
Now, what kind of reaction do you get from fans? Is it more toward Empire Strikes Back, Flash Gordon, Superman?
Oh, it's all Empire Strikes Back. Yeah, I mean...
And that's what you're here for today. There's kind of this Boba Fett reunion. You were you were a body double for, like, whenever Jeremy Bullock...
Well, it was only one time.
Okay.
It was the scene where Boba Fett says to Darth Vader, "He's no good to me dead." And Jeremy was called off to do a couple of days shooting on another film. So I had no idea really what Boba Fett was all about, but I stepped into the role and got a bit of coaching from Jeremy as how to play it. He said, play it like Clint Eastwood, and the rest is history.
I mean, that's an excellent way of putting it, too, because, I mean, he is one of the coolest bounty hunters ever. Yeah. When you first saw the costume, what did you think?
Well, I didn't really get it.
Had you been a Star Wars guy up until then? Like, that wasn't in your wheelhouse at that point.
Okay. No, because I was purely based in the UK, and, I was really focused on my own career and what I was doing. And the scuttlebutt on Star Wars earlier in 76, 77, before it came out, as far as the UK was concerned, it was just some kind of ramshackle sci-fi film that, could be ridiculous. Nobody really knew. And, of course, all of the enthusiasm about the film was here in the United States. There was a little bit in the UK. But certainly by the time they did Empire Strikes Back, everybody knew that it was a big hit, and we're very excited to be a part of it. But we didn't really have a sort of a fan-based approach to the film. And I wouldn't say that I could characterize myself as a Star Wars fan until 1997 with the re-releases, where the fan community pulled me and many other actors who were a part of it into the galaxy. And really, I sort of became a person who lived into Dak and subsequently Boba Fett.
Now that's another character we want to talk about, Dak.
Yeah.
Again, the iconic line.
Right now I feel like I can take on the Empire all by myself.
And have you seen the Family Guy spoof on it?
Don't ask me to go there, please, Joe. Oh, geez.
It
really pains me when fans come up and say, hey, would you sign the line? And
was it like a Family Guy, would they give you pictures or something?
No, they'd have me do the
ring.
Yeah, but it's such a tacky line.
Right. Well, for somebody who hasn't seen it, he's like, they're like, hey, Dak's got this one. We're, But that is cool that you get to. Now, what happened? What is it? Dak Ralter.
Yeah.
Is the character we're talking about. This is Luke's gunner on Hoth, in the snowspeeder.
Yeah.
And what happened? What happened with Dak? Was he, should he have banked something? Or, well, I guess Luke's flying. He's just the gunner. So, are you blaming Hamill for this? What's the deal?
No, I think it was the INCOM engineers that designed the combat system. They didn't get the software right, and so
no shields.
We lost fire control in the shields. So, blame it on the contractor. It's it's one of those waste, fraud, and abuse things.
Are these the same contractors who own the Death Star that left the panel open?
Oh no! This was INCOM. These are the guys that walked away with the Death Star plans and the X-Wing fighter plans.
How cool was it to shoot at that time? Because you're getting to work with Irvin Kershner,
yeah,
who's one of the greatest directors of all time. And this isn't like CGI world like we have now. I mean, I love all the Star Wars movies, but they're basically shot, not sure what J.J. Abrams is doing, but the prequels basically shot in a computer. You are in the snow. You're shooting this on location.
Well, actually, it was a Norwegian extra who did that sequence that was in the glacier in Norway. I came on to the set about 2 weeks later after they came back to Elstree. And so
you got to avoid the snow.
I got to avoid the snow.
Oh, wow.
So that was the good news, the bad news. It was sort of a bad news, good news thing. I knew I was cast in the film as a rebel pilot. And so when I arrived on the set with great fanfare, they said, well, John, here's the good news. You're going to be Mark Hamill's co-pilot. And I said, oh, wow, everybody's going to remember this.
Yeah.
My career is set.
Which you remember Wedge and all these guys. I mean, anybody that's with Luke gets to be the hero too, right?
But to be his co-pilot.
Yeah. And Hamill's making it out alive.
Yeah. So they said, well, that's the good news. The bad news is you're already dead. Oh, really? Yeah. Yes, you died in Norway.
How could you die if you're with Mark Hamill? I mean, that would be the big thing. It's like, he's the Jedi Knight. Why didn't he should have banked harder?
The funny thing is that the fans, when I first started doing these appearances 10, 15 years ago, they'd sort of say, hey, was Luke going back for his lightsaber, or was he going back to save Dak? What do you think? And I'd throw it back to the fans and say, okay, let's take a poll. What do you all think? About 90% would say he's going back for the lightsaber.
Yeah.
Only 10% would go back for that.
Yeah, I guess he hasn't really checked to see if the body is cold, right? It's like he's done something with him.
Tim Zahn says that you have to look at this issue of canon and extended universe and the films all through the same lens, which is that they are reports of things that happened in the galaxy. And all good journalists, as you would know, Joe, sometimes get reports that are incorrect or inaccurate, and so there's a lot of retconning or revisionist history that goes back. So I would argue this, that Dak really didn't die. You know, it seemed that way from the documentary film of, what happened on Hoth. But in fact, he was retrieved by a rescue squad, and he was taken quickly to a Bacta tank because he possessed either a holocron or a data card that had all vital information on the Rebel Alliance. And so that's what Luke Skywalker was going back for, was Dak.
Okay.
Because he had it, in his flight suit.
So are you saying there's like maybe the AT-AT walkers, they have hollowed out feet?
Oh, they
so
do.
Maybe it just didn't. Okay, so yeah, it just sort of like was a dome.
Also,
over
it was a snowbank and it just kind of pressed.
And protected him.
Yeah, and so he was okay.
And so Dak's fine.
So Dak came back to life.
Wife and kids?
Wife and kids.
Sitting there, enjoying life.
He came down to this galaxy, and he's now consulting in Washington, D.C., and he's,
J.J. Abrams calling you now?
J.J. Abrams would have to call, Vint Cerf, I think, to find me. But there is all this backstory, because there's a lot of, the real backstory, West End Games that had the holocron before Leland Chi. For the role-playing games in the 1980s and 1990s, when I got back into it, I found out all this stuff on Dak, where he was born in captivity in a prison planet called Kallus VI. He escaped with a guy named Breg. They landed in Tirfon. Dak ended up flying with the Tirfon Yellow Aces and was an X-Wing fighter pilot, quite distinguished. And so he appears in all of the gaming of that era.
So you go deep into the mythology.
Well, it was already done by West End.
But I mean, you know all this stuff. You can have a conversation with the fans.
Oh yeah.
And like out nerd them at any given turn.
No, I wouldn't go that far.
But pretty close. You can hold your own.
But Lucasfilm, when they found out that I was doing a lot of writing in my day job, a lot of it was military writing, they said, would you like to do a series picking up on Mike Stackpole's X-Wing fighter series, first-person account of Dak as an X-Wing fighter pilot? So I worked up a lot of outlines and story arcs for Lucasfilm. Basically, before we really got this thing fleshed out and underway, the decision was made between them and Del Rey to focus on episode one. So the thing went onto the shelf. So I haven't done very much with it since, but stuff is out there.
Possibly down the line.
That I've elaborated on. So I think as far as Dak coming to life, it's more likely that he's going to come to life in some sort of X-Wing series, if it ever gets redone.
Okay, well, we know it's going back to Marvel. The books are going back to Marvel, so there's going to be a lot of stories. So maybe we'll see Dak in a comic book format.
Either comic book format or, a novel of some kind.
Perfect.
I'm out there. It's just got to be trying to put a deal together and whether Lucas and Disney want it.
And speaking of comics, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about the IndyCast hosts. Ed Dahlstedt's favorite film, Flash Gordon. Or one of his favorite films, I should say, Flash Gordon. You have a role in Flash Gordon as well, the 1980 classic sci-fi film here.
That wasn't exactly in outer space, but I was a pilot. At the beginning of the film, I picked up Flash and Melody Anderson's characters after the Super Bowl and crashed into Billy Utkin's laboratory. So you see, I'm not a guy to be flying with.
No, you don't have anything. Do you have any pilot background at all?
No, I was a Navy.
You're at sea.
Surface warfare guy.
You should stay at sea. Don't go in the air.
Yeah, great to be in the maritime environment, but don't go into aerospace with Dak.
Some classic characters, and we appreciate you taking some time with us today. Well, how can fans find out more about you? Website, Twitter, Facebook, where
A website are you? Is in process of being built. It's called www.tapcaf.net, TAPCAF.net, and my Twitter handle is @tapcaf, TAPCAF.
And people can ask you Dak questions, Nate questions, yeah. Flash Gordon questions, whatever
yeah,
you want.
I'd say that for the moment, until we get this website worked up, find me on Twitter. That's the best way.
How's the fan reaction here in Cincinnati?
Pretty good. I mean, most of the people are actually coming for Dak, although we're being featured as the Bounty Hunter Reunion. But it really depends on, you know, where folks are and their collecting and what have you. You know, when I came back to do my first celebration since Celebration 1, I had a huge number of people coming for the Boba Fett angle. Excellent. About as many as Dak. Now I'd say it's probably about 3 or 4 to 1 Dak to Boba Fett.
And well, he's one of the coolest characters, Boba Fett is, but I always have a soft spot in my heart for Nate.
Yeah.
Poor Nate.
You know the Superman series pretty well.
I do, yeah. I'm Comic Book Central, so those are some of my favorite films. But I tell you what, we just saw Superman 2 over and over again, yeah. So I memorized all the lines, and just a great film.
Joe, I would fail to give you and the fans a big kick when I did the dubbing for my scene in Superman 2. I had the pleasure of meeting Chris, and Chris Reeve was a prince of a man. I'd say 2 hours in the dubbing studio with him as we were sort of rotating in and things were getting set up, and he was an authentic guy. Very humble, didn't have that kind of star quality stuff that separated him from you. He was certifiably a star, but he was a wonderful human being. And I just want to pass that on. That'll reassure your fans and his fans that he was one of the most remarkable men.
Are you a fan of the Superman films?
Yeah.
What do you think of them?
Yeah, I think they're fantastic. I haven't seen the Man of Steel, but I intend to. But you know, the originals with Chris Reeve, were really wonderful films. And I have to say that I was, as a child, I was into the comics, but the Superman TV series, with George Reeve, really had an impact on me as a kid.
It's amazing because I think every generation has their own Superman. So
yeah.
Yours is George Reeves, mine's Christopher Reeve.
Yeah.
Now we've got Henry Cavill. So it's just that character that just keeps going on and on.
Well, I think when you have something that touches a nerve in a culture, in a society, and reaches every succeeding generation, it's pervasive, which is why I think Star Wars, which is really my world, is so interesting and exciting. Depending on the generation, you have fans that grew up on the originals. Then you have other fans that came to it through the extended universe with, Tim Zahn's writing. Then others that came of age with the prequels. And then others that take on Clone Wars. And George Lucas kind of recognizes that and understands that, each bandwidth of generations has their own partiality of what is the primary. But it's all Star Wars. And it has to be, attributed to George's vision that this thing is going to be with us for many generations, as we're looking into the future. And I think the good news is that Disney is handling that franchise very well. The folks that are into Marvel seem to be very happy with the way that Disney has handled Marvel, and so therefore that's a good omen for where they're going with Star Wars. But at the same time, the people who are responsible for the legacy of Star Wars are folks that are in their 30s and 40s who grew up on the playgrounds and in the backyards and neighborhoods with the Star Wars toys.
Swinging those Kenner lightsabers. And,
exactly.
Yeah, we were all doing it.
So, that's they're approaching their responsibility to husband that legacy as fans like everybody else. So I think it's in good hands.
Hey, thank you so much. John Warren, thank you for joining me on the show today.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. And have a great convention. Enjoy Cincinnati.
It's great being here. Thank you, sir.
Yep, I always liked Nate the astronaut in that movie. He was so laid back and cool, just so nonchalant up there on the moon. But, he was laid back and cool until Nan started trashing his space capsule. Yeah, unfortunately, in Superman 2, we saw the last of Nate, but hey, let's hope we haven't seen the last of Dak. Come on, Marvel, bring Dak back. Hey, if they do, I'm sure you're going to hear all about it on John's website. It's TapCaf, TAPCAF.net. And be sure to follow John on Twitter at TapCaf. Next up, I'm telling you what, meeting Lou Ferrigno at the Expo certainly brought back my childhood in a big, big way. And so did meeting my next guest. If Friday nights belong to Lou Ferrigno and the Hulk, then Tuesday nights belong to Henry Winkler and the gang from Happy Days. Come on, how cool was the Fonz? He was the coolest. That's how cool the Fonz was. Okay, now I know what you're thinking. What does Happy Days have to do with comic books? Well, I will say this. Happy Days was so popular, in 1979, Gold Key released 6 issues of a Happy Days comic book. I can hear you headed to eBay right now to go get them. Yeah, they're pretty cool, so pick them up if you can. And hey, get this. On the season finale of the animated series, Batman the Brave and the Bold, Henry Winkler became the first actor to bring the DC Comics character Ambush Bug to life.
Cancel Brave and the Bold? What's he think he's doing? Batmite may be an all-powerful being from the fifth dimension, but he's not a god, or more importantly, a network programmer. Someone's got to stop him. This sounds like a job for Ambush Bug. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Oh, I loved Batman the Brave and the Bold. Each episode was really off the wall, and the finale was no exception. The story actually revolves around Batmite, played by Paul Reubens. That's right, Pee-wee Herman. Batmite was trying to get the animated series canceled by making it jump the shark. Nice Happy Days callback there. And the finale features a guest appearance by Henry's Happy Days buddy, Ted McGinley, as Aquaman. How cool is that? If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's a fantastic episode in a very cool series. And Henry is awesome as Ambush Bug. Now, Henry's also pretty amazing when it comes to being an author. Now, since 2003, he has written a number of children's books about a young boy named Hank Zipser, who is dyslexic. And the books are based on Henry's own experience with dyslexia. So I got a chance to ask him about that series as well. Now, I have to say, on the day I was at the expo, Henry was not scheduled to do any interviews. He was just meeting and greeting the fans. But remember I said Fonzie was a cool character? Yeah, well, Henry's even cooler. He took a few moments away from what he was doing to join me here on Comic Book Central. Very cool move. So without further ado, I give you a few moments with Arthur Fonzarelli, Chuck Lumley, Barry Zuckerkorn, and of course, Ambush Bug, the one, the only, Henry Winkler. I am here at Cincinnati Comic Expo with the one and only Henry Winkler, Arthur Fonzarelli. Also for comic book fans, Ambush Bug.
Yes.
Is this one of the craziest projects that you got a chance to do? This is on the season finale of Batman Brave and the Bold. You got to come in.
I was in Boston. I was making Here Comes the Boom. And on my day off, I went in and recorded Ambush Bug. It was fantastic. I felt great. And then they sent me this beautiful rendering of Ambush Bug. And I thought, I look great in tights.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Now, what I loved about this episode was it was a season finale. It was kind of like posed as this jump the shark kind of moment, which
right.
You are forever associated with. So for the fans who aren't familiar with jump the shark, how did that originate on Happy
You know
Day?
What? A young man was in his dorm at Michigan State, and he came up with the phrase. He thought when I jumped the shark on Happy Days that the show had jumped the shark, you know, Ed. But we were number one for four years later.
Which I was going to say it hadn't, because the reality
so
was
it didn't really matter.
Show.
And I finally met him, John Heim, and I did his radio show.
Now, what I loved about the role of Ambush Bug is that this whole thing is themed around that. They bring Ted McGinley in.
Right.
Now, did you actually work with Ted
while
you were recording?
No.
Not
no.
on that.
I
sometimes
all
they bring everybody
Yeah, but I did all myself in Boston. They all recorded in L.A.
Right.
But Ted McGinley is a great young man. One of the most handsome men. There must be 19 people who are ugly because he got all the good looking.
He still looks exactly the same as he does, as he did back
I'll
then,
bet
too.
He does.
I want to talk about the Hank Zipser books that you're writing.
Yes.
Is it with Lynn Oliver?
Lynn Oliver is my partner. She is magnificent. We have written 27 novels together.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Okay, now these are based on the character of Hank Zipser.
These are based on me growing up with dyslexia.
Okay.
And they are comedies, and they are about a young man who, his personality, his imagination has got zest. And he is just his glasses half full.
What's the message you want to send to people
that
with the book?
That kids have greatness inside them. Their job is to figure out what it is and give it to the world as a gift.
How can we buy those books? How can we
Any great independent bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
Thanks. Henry Winkler, thanks for joining me today. Yeah, again, class move by Henry Winkler. I appreciate him giving up some time, and it was really cool meeting him. Check out your local library or buy the Hank Zipser books. Great work Henry is doing. And you can follow him on Twitter at HWinkler4Real. HWinkler4Real. Okay, folks, it is Indiana Jones time. Time for an indie-style adventure with stuntman Dickie Beer. Joining me now is Dickie Beer, and wow, you were in just about everything. So we're doing the Comic Book Central podcast. We also have the IndieCast. You were in a good share of comic book movies, Indiana Jones movies, stuntman extraordinaire. Tell us how you got into the business a little bit to begin with, and what the appeal of stunts were.
Well, the way I got in was sheer luck. I didn't know anything about the film industry. I was looking for a job, and a friend told me about an audition that was going on somewhere for a movie that was made back in Holland. And I went there, got the job, and that was it. You know, I was in the business.
Now, how did you get into stunt work? What's your background as far as physical training?
No,
what were some of the initial projects that you did?
I had hardly any physical training. I was just like a healthy young kid. And my background was car racing. So, you know, racing cars, motorbikes.
What type of cars did you race?
I did all sorts. I did single seaters, and but also Formula, like the Formula Ford, Formula Volkswagen, it was called in those days, Formula V. And, you know, standard cars. So.
Now, do you remember the first movie that you were in, the first stunt that you ever did?
The first movie I was in was A Bridge Too Far. And
pretty good way to start.
Yeah. And I was a dead soldier in a Jeep that was driven around by James Caan.
Wow.
And that was my first job ever in the industry.
Okay. Now, how did you get into the Indiana Jones series of films? Now, you weren't in Raiders of the Lost Ark, correct?
No.
Started in Temple of Doom.
Correct.
So you had seen Raiders of the Lost Ark up until then? Were you an Indiana Jones?
No, I've seen the movie, yes.
Were you an Indiana Jones fan going into it?
No.
I would think that the stunts would have appealed to you from that.
No, it was just, you know, movies were just my work at that time, so...
Just another gig?
Just another gig, and, you know, I was asked to work on it, and I did.
Now, how were you approached to be in Temple of Doom? What did they say they needed you to do?
I just got a phone call saying, do you want to work on our show? And I said, yeah, and that was it. And didn't know what I was going to do. You'll find out when you work. So.
Now, where can we see you in the film? Stunt?
Over the place. But in Temple of Doom, the scene that a lot of people remember is the... the rope bridge, when it breaks, I was part of that. Especially the scene where they end up hanging on the side of the cliff and fighting each other, and then eventually, you know, the bad guys are all thrown.
Now, are you one of the thuggy guards?
Yeah, I'm one of those. Several of those.
You're one of the guys that goes down into the down to the crocodile. So.
Correct.
Now,
correct.
So you went out on the bridge.
Yes.
Okay, for our listeners, describe just the first time you went out on the bridge. You're not afraid of heights.
No, not
so
really.
So, for what was that like? Because just even watching it gives me the creeps.
It's just a bridge. I mean, it's
pretty amazing bridge.
To get from one side to the other side of a ravine. That's what it was.
Wow.
And the real one was built in Sri Lanka. And then part of it was
when they actually built stuff.
Yeah.
Not computers.
No, that was actually built. It was not computer.
Yeah, a whole different world back then.
Yeah.
You had to hang off a bridge.
Yes.
if it was a bridge in the script, you're hanging off a bridge.
Correct, yes.
Wow. So then Last Crusade, how did you get involved in that?
Same way. I was asked mainly because of my work that I already did on Temple of Doom. And because of my work on that one, they asked me to do the next one as well.
So what kind of stunts were you able to do in Last Crusade?
Same thing, like we were all over the place. But
were you in the boat chase?
Yeah, I was driving one of the boats.
Oh, you actually drove one of the boats?
Yeah, and I'm the character that fights Harrison when the speedboat goes into the ship's propeller.
That's you in the boat there?
Yes.
Okay. Now, describe that scene, too, because that looked like some of those blades. I mean, obviously, it's Hollywood magic, but it actually, you could see that thing getting busted up pretty good. Any close calls while you're filming any of these movies?
No, it's all that is the movement of that boat was completely controlled. So underwater, it was on tracks. It wouldn't go any further than to a safe mark. And the chopping up was real.
But you're still sliding around on a boat, so you can't. I mean, you're still stuntmen throwing each other around. Any kind of close calls on the film?
It was actually Whit Harrison. Like he was in that scene as well.
Okay. Now we always hear about how he likes to do physical acting, how he likes to do stunts. How good of a stuntman, or at least a physical actor, is he?
If he wouldn't be an actor, he would be a stuntman.
That's high praise.
Yeah.
So he knows how to throw a punch. Like you didn't have to go. You didn't have any concerns or worries that you were going to get cut.
With him, like he's so well. I mean, he's a stuntman, really. He's an action actor. He's you can just rely on him knowing what he's doing, and he won't get anybody in danger. It came to a point where we actually had to say to him, like, Harrison, this is going too far. You cannot do this. This is too dangerous.
Oh, he actually wanted to do something that you didn't allow him to do. What was the? Do you remember what he wanted to do that he couldn't?
Well, most of the fighting and the jumping off stuff and swinging with his bullwhip. You know,
right before he bursts in to see his dad.
Yeah, from one side of the castle to the other. He wanted to do all that himself, and he actually did, but. Some of the scenes we said, like, nah, that's too tricky, it's too high up, you better not.
Yeah.
So we had this stunt double.
What does he say when you say, okay, not this one?
Doesn't like it, but then eventually he looks at it and then he realizes, yeah, it wasn't necessary that I was doing that.
Yeah.
So he's pretty cool about that.
Now, Superman, Supergirl, did you get to work with Christopher Reeve on Superman at all?
Yeah, but not much.
Like, minimal?
I was only involved in one of the scenes, which was at the factory where, what was it again, a lot of explosions and people in white suits running across a bridge. And all
In Superman 3?
Yes.
With the chemical plant explosion?
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
So I was in that scene, and that was shot in Calgary, in Canada. I didn't do any of the work in the studios in England.
Did you get to meet Christopher Reeve?
Yeah, I met him, yeah.
What kind of guy?
Great, nice.
Yeah.
You know, very... He was still, you know, starting. You know, he was like an upcoming actor. He was. I met him on Superman 1, which I didn't work on, but I was in the studio when we were there. He's a very friendly, nice guy. You know?
And you're here in Cincinnati as part of this Boba Fett reunion?
Yes.
You've got some Boba Fetts. You were doubling in which ones?
I did the scenes in all the scenes with Boba Fett around the Sarlacc pit. So when he flies from the ship and the fight starts and then he gets knocked out by Luke Skywalker and flies across, hits the ship and then...
So you're the Boba Fett that dies?
Yeah.
Okay, well, if he died. Yeah. I guess there's always the question, did he die or not?
I think he didn't, because I'm still here.
Boba Fett is alive and well, and we got a bunch of them here today. How are the crowds treating you here in Cincinnati?
Yeah, nice. I like the people.
Fantastic. Nice. Dickie Beer, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
You're welcome.
Oh, that rope bridge scene still freaks me out every time I see it. I can't believe they actually built the thing and filmed on it. Yikes. And you know what? It's thanks to stuntmen like Dickie Beer that the indie films look so realistic. I think that's why we can't get enough of them. You know, someone else who made the Indiana Jones movie so memorable is Indy's cinematic sidekick, Sala. Sala could be singing Gilbert and Sullivan one minute and fighting Nazis the next. And the amazing actor who had the pipes and the punches to pull it all off is John Rhys-Davies. Welsh-born actor John Rhys-Davies made numerous appearances throughout the 70s on UK television before gaining worldwide recognition on the series I, Claudius with Star Trek's Patrick Stewart and the miniseries Shogun. That was the latter that caught the attention of a Hollywood director preparing to film an epic adventure featuring a certain professor-slash-archaeologist. John's performance as Sala was so memorable in Raiders of the Lost Ark, Steven Spielberg and George Lucas brought him back for Indy's third cinematic go-round, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Not one to settle for one film franchise, John brought in a whole new legion of fans with his performance as the dwarf Gimli in Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy. And he continues to be a fan favorite with his roles in the Bond flick, The Living Daylights, the universe-hopping sci-fi show Sliders, reuniting with Stewart on Star Trek The Next Generation, and he was the first actor to portray Marvel Comics' The Kingpin, Wilson Fisk, in a live-action film, The Trial of the Incredible Hulk.
My guest today played a feature role in what I consider to be the greatest film of all time, Raiders of the Lost Ark. He also inhabited Middle-earth as the dwarf Gimli in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I want to welcome to the show John Rhys-Davies. John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, my dear boy.
No pressure. It's my favorite movie of all time, but whatever. You know, no pressure on that. Hey, that's my favorite movie. You're in it. What's your favorite movie of all time?
Oh, it would probably be something typical like Casablanca or Les Enfants du Paradis or something like that. But okay. Of the films that I've been in and enjoyed, I think Raiders is one of the classics up there, along with Lord of the Rings as well.
Okay, Sala Mohammed Faisal Al-Kahir. Did I get it right?
That's right. I think that's the...
pretty close on.
Yes.
Role was originally intended for Danny DeVito. You're not Danny DeVito. How in the world did you get this?
I don't know that it was originally intended to Danny DeVito. Perhaps it was, but anyway, I got lucky, that's all. Stephen had seen Shogun and basically wanted, he told me that what he wanted was a combination of Falstaff and the character I played in Shogun.
Okay, so did you get much of a backstory as you're going through with Raiders? Because obviously Indy and Sala have worked together in the past. Actors sometimes make up their own backstory when they go through. Did you kind of do that when you went, oh, they probably did this adventure together?
Well, if we did, it was many years ago and I've forgotten now.
What's the backstory you want to make up today?
Oh, well, I think Sala probably grew up with Howard Carter as a little guy working for Howard Carter, and picked up a few good ideas from that, you know, Tutankhamun and this and like that.
Well, we know Indy and Sala did raid the tomb of Tutankhamun in one of the books, so you get a little bit of a backstory, so see, you're not far off. All right, one of my buddies over at the IndyCast wants to know, how many times do you think Sala has seen or listened to the HMS Pinafore?
I think many, many times. Probably when he was a young man listening to some English archaeologist stuck in the desert with one disc on his old wind-up gramophone. And that's probably where he's got it.
Just over and over and over again, of course. When you were kissing Karen Allen, how many takes did you do?
Not enough.
I'm going to guess that's probably the best part of filming Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Working with Karen Allen was a joy. She is a golden soul and just a natural and lovely human being. You know, she's a fine, fine actress and a good star. But it's really as a human being that I most highly respect her. You know, she's lovely. Karen is just wonderful.
Different take on the character in Last Crusade, much more expanded role, but a much more comedic role.
Yes.
Which Sala do you kind of like better? Do you gravitate toward? Obviously, the ones with the more lines. I'm guessing, but a little bit more of a you know, comedic take.
Well, I guess that it has to be what the director wants, you know, and the director's main concern was that interesting balance between between father and son there. And so, you know, of course, the friend has to play a more minor line. But there is a shift, isn't there, between our perception of Salah the Arab as time goes on. And I'm not even sure that the American audience is willing now to conceive of an Arab character who's a good guy and a hero. That is the tragedy of Western Arab relationships over the last 20, 30 years.
So do you think we'll see Salah again? I mean, obviously Disney's going to do something with Indiana Jones 5. Have they talked to you at all about bringing Salah back? Would you be interested in bringing Salah back?
I would love to come back. I did get off at a little cameo in the other one, the last one, but it basically involved sort of coming in, sitting down in a chair, smiling.
At the wedding.
They were going to cut into the wedding. I thought not really, no. I think the character's more valuable than that.
And he probably wouldn't come all the way into Connecticut for the wedding. Just, I mean, there would have to be an adventure involved.
Well, it would have thought.
Where do you see Salah today? What would you like to see him do? Or if there is an Indiana Jones 5 and you're in it, where are they going? What are they doing?
Well, let's put it this way. If it's set in the desert, it would make sense to have Salah in it. If it isn't set in the desert, I don't suppose we shall see Salah. I suspect that Salah is out for the reasons I've already suggested anyway. But you know, these are great, great movies. And there is a strange and lovely... It's good to be reminded that some of those minor colonial characters that litter these films did exemplify the characteristics that we like loyalty, friendship, courage. And perhaps we need a little bit of that in the second and third world characters in film today.
Now, Lou Ferrigno is right around the corner. I don't know if you had a chance to touch base with him while you're here in Cincinnati.
Very much so.
You played the Kingpin.
I did.
Okay, he wasn't called the Kingpin in The Trial of the Incredible Hulk, but we know it's Wilson Fisk, we know it's the Kingpin. Very cool take on him. Had you been familiar with the character before that, or is this just kind of
Well, it was just one of those characters that comes along, you know, and you turn up and they want you to shave all your hair off, and you say, well, no one told me that, but we made it work. I'll tell you what, Lou is another one of those golden souls that exists. And Bixby himself, he was a jewel. He was deep down decent guy. And in the end, there are considerable stars that have been friends of mine, acquaintances of mine, that have died. And I've said, oh, that's sad. But when somebody like Bixby goes, you know, you go, damn, the world has lost a really good man. And I suppose... If you want to be remembered, that is how to be remembered best.
And you were directed by him in that movie. So how great of director was he, too? I mean, he's multitasking in that one.
Of course he's multitasking. But then you see, good actors have had more experience of directing than most directors do. Why? Because we work with lots of directors. So we can see the ones who are good. We can see the ones who are bad. We can adapt and evolve and incorporate the tricks and the techniques of the good ones, and we know what to avoid. Above all, most actors who become directors actually like directing their fellow actors, and actors like working with their fellow actors, because we speak a language that actor to actor we understand.
So what have you got going on? How can fans find out more about you? Website, social
networks? I try to avoid all that.
You've gone dark.
I tell you what, I like to show you my state-of-the-art phone. This man is laughing at a 6310 Nokia, circa 1999.
I like it. I wish we could go back to that. That would be awesome. So.
Well, it's not that. It's just I read a lot. I still try and play with mechanical things. I have an 8-year-old daughter, and I do too much reading online anyway. I really don't want to get into Twitter and Facebook and all that sort of stuff. So
we'll watch your IMDb page and we'll look for those projects as they're coming up too. Well, hopefully maybe some more stuff with Peter Jackson and maybe Indy 5.
Well, you never know. One lives in hope.
We'll keep a good thought. So
yeah.
John Reese Davies, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And good wishes and luck to all of you fans out there. Thank you very much.
Big thanks to John for taking some time away from a pretty sizable line of indie fans and Lord of the Rings fans. He had a very limited window at the event, as one would expect, so I truly appreciate the time he was able to take to sit down and join me here on Comic Book Central. And while we may or may not see Sala again, as Disney decides what to do with the Indiana Jones franchise, there is no doubt we're going to be seeing plenty of John Rhys-Davies. Just a quick scan of his IMDb page shows no less than 6 projects in various stages of production, so we are looking forward to seeing what amazing performances are on the horizon. And something else that's on the horizon, the 1-year anniversary of Comic Book Central. That's right, I launched this very podcast November 8th, 2013. My special guest for the premiere episode was the godfather of comic books, Stan the Man Lee. Along the way, many more guests made reservations here in the lair. To mark the occasion, Friday, November 7th, I'm going to air a special episode of Comic Book Central. I'm going to revisit some of my favorite moments on the show. And here's where you get to lend a hand. A lot of you reached out to tell me that you're enjoying the podcast, but I want to know, what are your favorite moments from the show? I know what my favorite moments are, but I'm interested to find out what you enjoyed most. So shoot me a line at joe@comicbookcentral.net, or you can click the Signal Me tab on the website, or drop me a line on Facebook at facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork, or tweet me at the Twitter at comicbookctrl. Hey, Comic Book Central is everywhere online, so check it out. And don't forget, there's an episode guide on the About section of the Facebook page that might come in handy. So tell me what you liked. I'm going to replay those memorable moments on the show that airs Friday, November 7th, so be sure to get those to me soon. I'm looking forward to reliving some of those moments myself. Well, folks, that is all the time we have for today, and that wraps up my adventure at Cincinnati Comic Expo. Looking forward to heading back next year, September 18th through the 20th. For more information on the show, the website, of course, is cincinnaticomicexpo.com. My thanks to Andrew Satterfield and Matt Bredesteggy from the Expo, and to everyone who joined me on Comic Book Central the past couple of weeks. But hey, don't think that because the Expo is over that things are going to slow down here at the Lair. Oh no, my friends. Things are heating up because next week on Comic Book Central, from one of the hottest films of the year, the summer blockbuster that is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I'm sitting down with the arch enemy of those heroes in a half shell, the man who played Shredder, Toru Masamune. It's going to be a great one. Until then, have an amazing week. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the Lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations, 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Asps. Very dangerous. You go first.